Monday, June 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. says it's about to impose even more crushing sanctions on Iran.
My worry is that this administration has been so erratic that we could bumble into war even if they don't intend it.
North Korea's leader praises a letter he received from President Trump. Also ahead, the Material Girl, also known as Madonna, does it again with yet another chart topper. It's all on today's International Edition. Ethiopia's government foiled a coup attempt in a region outside the capital, Addis Ababa. Ethiopia's chief of staff and at least three other senior officials were killed during the coup attempt by an army general on Saturday. The attempted coup in Amhara is the latest challenge to Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who was elected last year as a reform-minded young leader. Abiy has captured the imagination of many of his political and economic reforms, including their surprise acceptance of a peace agreement with bitter rival Eritrea, the opening of major state-owned sectors to private investment, and the release of thousands of prisoners, including opposition figures once sentenced to death. We get the latest now from Kenya Citizen TV.
Now to some news out of Ethiopia, where the country's army chief of staff, General Siyari Mekonnen, is among four people killed in a failed coup. Mekonnen and a former major general, Gezai Abera, were killed at Siyari's home by his bodyguard. Now the incident began on Saturday evening in Bahir Dar, the capital of Amhara, where the region's president, Ambachew Mekonnen, and Amhara regional government office advisor, Ezez Wase, were killed. Regional Attorney General Migbaru Kebede sustained heavy injuries and is undergoing medical treatment, the Prime Minister's office said. The Army Chief of Staff General Siyari was coordinating a response to the attack in Amhara when he was killed. The Prime Minister's Press Secretary Bilene Seyum confirmed the situation in the Amhara, located in the northwestern part of Ethiopia, is one of nine regional states in the country and is now under full control of the federal government.
The U.S. Embassy reported gunfire in the capital Saturday and urged people to be careful. The country is a key regional security ally for the United States and others in the rest of Horn of Africa region. The Trump administration plans to announce what it says will be significant sanctions on Iran aimed at further choking off resources that Tehran uses to fund its activities in the region. A senior Iranian military commander warned that any conflict in the Gulf could spread uncontrollably and threaten the lives of U.S. troops. President Trump responded on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, saying he is not seeking war with Tehran.
I think they want to negotiate, and I think they want to make a deal, and my deal is nuclear. Look, they're not going to have a nuclear weapon.
But retired admiral and former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mike Mullen, in an interview Sunday on ABC's This Week, said Iran is looking to restart its nuclear program, and that is a dangerous proposition.
Iran with a nuclear weapon would start to proliferate nuclear weapons in the Middle East, which is incredibly dangerous. Other countries would then probably generate that kind of capability. The Middle East has got a lot of problems, and we don't need more nukes.
Tensions remain high between Iran and the U.S. after President Trump Friday called off a military strike to retaliate for Iran's downing of an unmanned U.S. drone. Trump saying he stopped it, citing it would be a disproportionate response. My colleague Steve Miller spoke to VOA national security correspondent Jeff Seldon about the president's tweets about the decision not to strike.
President Donald Trump, using Twitter, which he does so often to communicate on major issues, went out and he tweeted that Iran on Monday shot down the unmanned drone, which has raised tensions even more in the region. And then he wrote in one of these tweets, "We were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night," he wrote on three different sites, he said. And that's when he said in this tweet, he asked how many people were going to die. And one of the generals that he was speaking to said, attacking these three sites would kill 150 people. And then he said 10 minutes before the strike was supposed to launch, he called it off because it wasn't proportionate. And then he raised the ante a little bit leaving the threat of military strikes against Iran out there, saying he's in no hurry. The military is rebuilt anew and, in quotes, ready to go, and the best in the world. He also said that the sanctions are biting and that he added more last night. So continuing his maximum pressure campaign, which is aimed, according to his administration, to squeeze Iran, force it back to the negotiating table to renegotiate a nuclear deal that will limit its ability to sponsor terrorism, to pursue ballistic missile technology. And that's where we are at the moment.
You mentioned in the president's tweet that he said that the U.S. response was not proportionate. Has there been any clarification on what the president meant by that?
I think the concern here is the danger of escalation. And according to some of the reporting that came out overnight before the president tweeted here in the U.S., was that there were concerns by the military that a strike that killed actual Iranian people, personnel, even military personnel on the ground, would raise the stakes, because you had Iran. What Iran said it did is it shot down basically a flying robot, an unmanned aerial drone, a very expensive one, but no lives were lost. The concern is, it seems, that if you then strike back and you take lives, well, then Iran is going to feel that the only retribution that is fair is if it responds and takes American lives. And, of course, there's been an ongoing concern about the safety of U.S. personnel, military personnel in Iraq and Syria, of U.S. assets, interests, and even private citizens in the Middle East, where Iran has some reach.
Leaders from around the globe, including U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, have called for cooler heads to prevail, for dialogue to begin to de-escalate the situation. Has there been any outreach to start that pathway for talks?
The pathway for talks right now is really going through back channels. You have the Swiss consulate in Tehran, which often will act as a messenger for the U.S., as the U.S. no longer has any diplomatic facilities in Iran and hasn't for quite some time. There's also the reporting that we talked about, where there are these back channels through Oman, where the U.S. was sending messages to Iran, we're going to strike, you need to come to the table or else. And then, of course, the strikes were called off. So there are some back channels, but really the international community is just voicing concern concern we've also heard from senior military personnel in the U.S. that there's a huge risk for miscalculation on the part of Iran and also the part of the U.S. And if something goes just a little bit wrong, both countries could see themselves with fewer and fewer options to respond, leaving them with really only a few choices, including all-out war.
All right, that's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. President Donald Trump sent a letter to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The official Korean Central News Agency posted a picture of a pensive Kim holding the letter, apparently with White House letterhead. It reported Kim as praising the letter and contemplating its content. Joining us to talk more about the president's strategy is James Kim, director of the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and Seoul, South Korea. What do you make of this ongoing mutual admiration, it would seem, between the North Korean dictator and the U.S. president?
I think President Trump has made clear that he wants a deal with Kim Jong-un, and I think Kim Jong-un is also on the same page with the president on that. So the letters are some ways in which both Kim Jong-un and President Trump can communicate directly with one another without having to go through the logistics of setting up a summit.
Do you think it's realistic to expect North Korea to give up its nuclear program?
I think the odds are against any sustainable deal that is workable for both the United States and North Korea. But there have been things in the past that have worked out against all odds. It's difficult for anyone, I think, to make any predictions about this, but clearly the odds are against the likelihood that there will be a sustainable negotiated solution to this problem.
After one of the two summits, the president declared that they are no longer a nuclear threat. So what are we to make of where we are now compared to that statement? And we really, supposedly there was something written down on paper, but it didn't seem like there was really any substantive deal.
I think the president, maybe what he was referring to to us that, you know, he's not in any rush and that North Korea doesn't pose an immediate threat at the moment. And so his statement alludes to the fact that North Korea hasn't tested any nuclear devices ever since the negotiations have started in 2018 with the first summit in Singapore and then a second summit in September 2018 in Hanoi. I think President Trump is also alluding to the fact that North Korea hasn't fired a intermediate range or intercontinental ballistic missile since towards the end of November of 2017. So I think President Trump sees these as a win, but North Korea still poses a threat because their capabilities have not been dismantled. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest that they're continuing to produce these weapons. And, you know, the big concern for the United States is maybe less, definitely a concern, but the direct threat that North Korea poses is definitely a concern. Also, the likelihood of proliferation, North Korea may sell some of these weapons to other state and non-state actors is a big concern, not only for the United States, but other countries around the world. So North Korea still clearly is a threat, if not a greater threat than they were even last year.
So if that's the case, are these diplomatic efforts and sort of normalizing of someone that, you know, by most standards that we've heard is a brutal dictator, do you still think that that would be the right avenue to take? And certainly to believe Kim Jong-un, given that the president, he likes compliments, and Kim Jong-un is writing him what President Trump says are beautiful letters. If it's only getting worse, is it doing the opposite by normalizing Kim Jong-un? Mm-hmm.
I think the jury's still out on that. It really depends on the outcome, I guess. But we've never taken this route before. We've never, when I say we, I'm talking about both the United States, South Korea and other countries that have been pressuring North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. Certainly, there were at least two negotiated solutions, but they were conducted in a manner that was very different than the approach that is being taken right now. We've never gone down this path of legitimizing and recognizing North Korea as a state that could be on par and negotiating with the United States. So in some ways, I think this is a really interesting experiment that we are conducting, but there are these risks, as you point out very nicely, that we may be legitimizing a brutal authoritarian regime that holds different values than the United States. It sets a really bad precedent for other countries that are watching this and thinking about whether or not they're going to be developing a nuclear weapon and how they ought to conduct themselves vis-a-vis the United States. I'm talking about countries like Iran, for instance. So there are risks here, but you could also argue on the other side that we've never gone down this path and taken this approach with North Korea. And there are some people that are saying that we ought to give North Korea room and concessions in order to give them some meaningful incentives for them to actually move forward with the denuclearization process. But I think most people will agree with the criticism against President Trump and the approach that he's taking. In essence, recognize North Korea's leader as someone that is on par or even with President Trump in being able to sit and negotiate and speak to him. I think with North Korea, there are a lot of bad choices, and most of them are all relatively equally bad. So the difficult choice here is, you know, which is the least of the worst choices that president can make. We've never tried this, and maybe the Trump administration's thinking is that this is something that we ought to give a try before we give in. So we're already down this path for about a year now, and this is going to be a very interesting experiment, but it's also very dangerous. So we're watching very carefully and trying to see if there are any changes in North Korean behavior and if they respond a little differently. What, if anything, we can learn from this, and the negotiations fail, we will learn something out of that experience. And as we move forward and dealing with, we'll have to continue to deal with North Korea if North Korea does not denuclearize in the future.
That's James Kim, director of the Asan Institute for Policy Studies. Meanwhile, Chinese President Xi Jinping has wrapped up a visit to North Korea, the first by a Chinese leader in 14 years. The visit came as both Xi and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are locked in their own standoffs with Trump. Though neither man publicly mentioned Trump during the visit, both likely hope their leverage with Trump has improved, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
From all outward appearances, Xi Jinping's visit to North Korea was meant to reinforce ties with a key ally. But the visit also sent a message to Donald Trump. Kim wants to show Trump he can look to China for economic help amid stalled nuclear talks. Xi, who's locked in a trade war with the U.S., is looking for leverage ahead of crucial talks with Trump next week.
Xi demonstrated his leverage over North Korea, and that will help improve his negotiating position ahead of his next summit next week at the G20 with Trump.
Xi offered to help with North Korea's security and development. He also vowed to play an active role in nuclear talks, but it's not clear how the visit will help move those talks forward.
To be honest, this summit will not satisfy Trump. North Korea has still not shown it will resume working-level talks, and it has not yet accepted the U.S. offer of a big deal.
Though the talks are stalled, there have been some signs of progress.
Personal, very warm, very nice.
Trump recently said he's received beautiful letters from Kim, and a breakthrough could come next week when Trump travels to South Korea. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Jared Kushner unveils a $50 billion peace to prosperity plan for the Middle East. A freed Taliban suspect finds his son was killed fighting for the Afghan army. Technology is helping people who are visually impaired to see art. And Oregon Republicans flee in the face of a climate change bill. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much, much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump puts ICE raids of illegal immigrants on hold for 2 weeks and gives Democrats a deadline to fix immigration. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says they've been offering compromises on immigration that some other Republicans accept, but President Trump never wants to take the deal. Instead,
he keeps threatening different policies and doesn't follow through. We're going to stop all trade with Mexico. We're going to now deport people. We're going to put tariffs on Mexico. It's erratic and inconsistent, and nothing is getting done.
Trump had called for the raids in more than a dozen major cities, then abruptly called them off. Schumer says the real immigration solution is to let people claim asylum in their home countries. Julie Walker, New York.
Well, as the UN marks International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence in Conflict this week, an initiative by the Foundation of Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Denis Mukwege helps to end the stigma of rape survivors. Solomon has this story.
Sexual violence is a devastating weapon of war accompanied by fear and misunderstanding. Perpetrators are often soldiers who act with impunity. Mildred, a survivor of conflict-related sexual violence from Zimbabwe, wrote, "Rapists have to be brought to justice. But how can we do this when the rapists are those in power?" Mildred is one of the women featured in a new initiative from the Foundation of Nobel Peace Prize recipient Dr. Denis Mukwege, designed to empower victims and educate the public about rape in conflict zones. In support of the UN International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence in Conflict, the Mukwege Foundation has created SEMA, the global network of victims and survivors to end wartime sexual violence. SEMA means speak out in Swahili, and the network includes 50 survivors across 21 countries. Milani Laksiminarian, program officer at SEMA, says the program aims to bring survivors together.
We focus on breaking the silence. We focus on building a collective memory. And what we do at the foundation is really provide a platform for these women to come together, to meet, to realize that they're not alone and become more empowered through this in order to fight for their own rights and demand their rights.
African countries are among the most affected by conflict-related sexual violence. In 2018 alone, the United Nations reported 1,049 cases affecting 1,041 women and girls and 8 men and boys in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and 238 incidents involving 1,291 victims in South Sudan, and 179 incidents affecting 259 victims in the Central African Republic. Although these figures are alarming, experts agree the vast majority of incidents go unreported. SEMA is working to break the silence.
I mean, what we've seen with the survivors is the moment that they see that they're not alone, they're much more ready to speak out because the stigma, if you don't feel that it's your fault, but if you realize this is actually a systematic pattern that's occurring, survivors are then much less likely to either put the blame on themselves or to feel that they have something to be ashamed about.
The Mukwege Foundation provides a platform for survivors to share their stories. It also seeks to secure reparations for survivors and has a treatment model based on holistic care that includes psychological support and legal assistance. Mukwege, a gynecologist, treats more than 3,500 women a year from Panzi Hospital in the DRC. His work to heal rape victims earned him the nickname Dr. Miracle. Rape causes not only physical harm and trauma, it often stigmatizes women within their communities. Some are shunned and made to feel at fault for what happened. Sema believes that creating an international support network can help decrease that stigma.
At the global level, because women actually see it's happening in other countries, which they often don't realize, they also understand, okay, this is not something that is done specifically to me, but we have this opportunity now to speak about it with others who know exactly what we've gone through, and we can really rely on support with them because they're the ones who really understand.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. A wildlife conservancy in Kenya has set up electronic sensors to monitor the animals in an effort to stop poaching and protect livestock that share the lands with lions, rhinos, and other wild beasts. Sarah Kamani reports from Laikipia in northern Kenya.
Olpejeta Wildlife Conservancy in Kenya's north is home to more than 150 rhinos. It is easy to spot them as well as other wildlife roaming freely. Maybe too easy. Poachers kill hundreds of rhinos each year for their horns, which are prized in Asia. That's why workers are setting up remote monitoring facilities to protect the wildlife here. This is where all the data will land, a lab set up with the help of tech company Liquid Telecom. With the data, park rangers will be able to tell where the parks of wildlife are in the vast sanctuary.
Traditionally, we have monitored those corridors by checking for footprints and estimating how many animals of certain species have moved either in or out. So with the technology of cameras, then we are able to tell with certainty that specific animals have moved in and out because they can be counted.
The technology is also meant to protect livestock from natural predators.
They lose about 60 cattle a year to the lions. So if you can, if you can track the positions of lions, if you can track the positions of cows, you can start to predict and help the farmers to make sure that they lose less, so they can move their cattle away when the lions are hunting. So these are the sorts of things that can make a difference.
Data from remote sensors is collected by a software platform called EarthRanger and sent to the lab.
It helps in making decisions and linking different sensors together in one platform to make a sober decision, either to prevent conflict, either to look at resources utilization and how they are being utilized in space.
Kenya and other sub-Saharan African countries have fought an uphill battle against poachers who also kill elephants for their ivory. The conservancy spends at least $10,000 every year to protect the animals from poachers. Officials hope the new technology will help bring down this cost and help stamp Kenya as a destination for wildlife tourism. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Laikipia.
Pop star Madonna continues to prove she has got what it takes. Her new album, Madam X, is her ninth number one album on the Billboard 200. Madonna has the second most number one albums among all female artists, only behind Barbra Streisand. The Material Girl's first top 10 album came 35 years ago with her self-titled album. This one is an ode to her love affair with Latin music and her time living in Portugal. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day. I bend my knees for you like a prayer. My God, look at me now. Build up my weakness, layer after layer.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After almost three decades, the United States reopened a permanent mission of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, in Somalia. On June 17th in Mogadishu, USAID Administrator Mark Green said the United States is opening the mission in Somalia's capital because the people of Somalia and the leadership of Somalia have shown a commitment to pursuing a more citizen-centered, more resilient, and more self-reliant future. And at USAID, when we find leaders who are willing to take on tough choices and the reforms that are necessary to pursue self-reliance, then we want to walk with them along the way. And that is what opening a mission is all about. On June 17th, Administrator Green announced that the United States will provide nearly $185 million in additional humanitarian assistance for the people of Somalia to address life-threatening food insecurity and acute malnutrition, and deliver safe water and emergency health care services to people affected by ongoing conflict and prolonged drought. The United States is the largest donor of humanitarian assistance to Somalia, providing nearly $672 million since the start of fiscal year 2018. In his remarks at the opening of the mission, Administrator Green praised the government and people of Somalia for the strides they have made over the last several years. Reform efforts based on a sincere commitment to peace, citizen responsive governance, and the expansion of economic opportunity have built a sense of optimism here and across the country that a brighter day does in fact lie ahead, he said. Administrator Green noted that Somalia continues to face great challenges and that its young democracy requires further nurturing. He called the elections, which are to be held next year, a historic opportunity for trying the principles of democratic representation, free and fair elections, and the peaceful transfer of power, turning that into practice. The establishment of the USAID mission in Mogadishu is an important milestone in deepening the U.S.-Somalia development partnership, declared Administrator Green. We're very proud to stand together and work with all of you towards a more stable, democratic, and prosperous future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. While U.S. President Trump prepares to announce new sanctions on Iran,